Bundi Avieson used to be in women's magazines. She was the editor of Woman's Day and the editorial director of New Idea. But in the early noughties, while in Bhutan with her husband, the country was changing, moving toward democracy. And Bundi found that her expertise was needed on the country's first independent newspaper, the Bhutan Observer.
The time that they decided to launch newspapers was around the same time that newspapers were being so challenged everywhere else in the world. So it was a big call for a couple of reasons, and it's had mixed success.
Well, that's it. You said there was one newspaper run by the government. Nobody read it. So there's yes. No culture of reading newspapers.
No, there's no culture of reading. It's an oral culture.
No culture of reading at all.
No culture of reading at all. That's changing slowly, but culturally, no. It's an oral culture where they had, there's something like 23 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and all of them are oral with no written form. And then the king decided about 30 years ago that they needed to be able to create a written form for one of these languages as part of this moving into the modern world. So while there was, the monasteries had prayer books and they had writing and reading, the mainstream people didn't write things down and they didn't read.
So in fact, isn't there a saying that if you want to keep a secret in Bhutan, write it in a book?
That's right, because no one will read it.
Okay, I can see what possessed you then.
It was a challenge, unlike any other.
Well, let's get a sense of the paper itself, so the office and the staff. Given that there's no real tradition of reading newspapers, how much training did the people who were actually putting the paper out have?
Well, they didn't have any training. Well, it varied. Some of them had gone to India and had worked on newspapers there or been trained. The newspaper that existed, the government one, had evolved over time. And the story of the government newspaper was quite an interesting one. The man who launched it, Kinley Dorji, came to Australia to learn to be a journalist. And he was the country's first journalist. And that was about 25, 30 years ago. And he was in the same year as Andrew Denton and Amanda Keller at Bathurst. And he was sent by the king at the time to go and learn to be a journalist, come back and start or move our government gazette towards being a newspaper. So that government gazette, Kunsul newspaper, was started by the country's first journalist that was trained in Australia. And then he trained people under him that worked on that newspaper. So there was, when I say that there was no tradition of newspapers, not amongst the mainstream, certainly the educated government people and the royal family read the newspaper, but the majority of people didn't. And so when the family that I knew decided they wanted to start a newspaper, there weren't any journalists to kind of, you know, poach or to, and they couldn't bring people in from outside.
How did they recruit?
Well, the recruiting was a lot of fun. They invited university graduates to come and explain what they would do on the newspaper. And the ones that wrote an essay in English that made the most sense about what a newspaper could be got the job. The sense of enthusiasm, and this is a brave new world, was brilliant.
And I suppose the other thing is that you don't know what you can't do. You're not restricted by the kind of the norms of doing a newspaper or the orthodoxies of how you do journalism.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that can be positive.
And they came up with such creative ways to do things. For example, there was no businesses to go and, say, buy space to sell your product. They just didn't have that kind of marketing, advertising culture. So what they did is they went to Wikipedia and downloaded a list of days. You know, like there's International Tuberculosis Day, International Handwashing Day, International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes.
They downloaded that list, highlighted all the ones that they thought were relevant, and then went to various NGOs and government departments to get them to sponsor information pullouts that week. So it wasn't advertising as we would recognise it. It was more public service pullouts that matched these international days.
All right, so how did it fit into this newly evolving media landscape? Because you've already mentioned there was the government paper, and I think there was another independent starting around the same time.
Yes, two of them launched at the same time, Bhutan Times and Bhutan Observer. Well, they were greeted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it appeared to a lot of the educated class that this was a good thing to do to launch newspapers. There are currently, or last time I looked, there was a dozen newspapers. All of them are failing. There still isn't advertising. There still isn't much of a newspaper culture.
What is in them? If I pick up one of these papers, if I pick up the paper you worked at, what am I going to read about, assuming I can read that language?
You'll read very much what's going on with the Bhutanese government, with what's happening in the main city of Thimphu. It's very local news, and it's things about the roads, what the farmers are doing, the price of potatoes. Very domestic news.
It's a very agricultural country, isn't it?
So yes.
You're going to, I imagine, there's going to be a lot about agriculture.
Yes. And there's also a lot about the royal family.
I guess the royal family's at the top of the hierarchy. Is there a tradition in which you can ask hard questions of people who are kind of not at your level?
It's a very hierarchical structure socially. So that has been a challenge for them with this new media landscape, or now having journalists asking questions, because traditionally you wouldn't. Traditionally you wouldn't ask questions of a very important person or somebody who was part of the senior government or certainly the royals. You just wouldn't question them. But that's being turned on its head now that they are a democracy and now that there is an active media.
And so how do the people who are not used to being asked questions, who've spent perhaps decades not being asked questions, when somebody rolls up and asks them a question?
It's been very challenging. So some of the government ministers have refused to respond. But they're in a state of everybody's learning their roles. So the journalists are learning to ask the hard questions and the ministers are learning to be accountable. And it's a bit of a dance and it's a bit of learning on both sides and in constant negotiation.
I can't ask about Bhutan without thinking of this gross national happiness, because that is probably the thing that Bhutan's best known for, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it real?
Yeah. Look, I spent a lot of time trying to get my head around gross national happiness. This is something that comes up in conversation pretty much every part of the day.
Really?
It is so much part of their public discussion about, yes.
So at news meetings, when you're trying to work out what you're covering, it's going to come up?
Yes, repeatedly. It is how they frame all of the what they consider to be progress within their country.
You tell a story actually in your book about a reporter who actually trailing along these sorts of public meetings where everyone says how full of gross national happiness they are, he actually tests that and finds it's not that simple.
Yes. Yes, he went along because they once a year they will go right across the country and interview every single inhabitant to ask them about their level of happiness and how they're going.
And people say they're fantastically happy, don't they?
People are confronted with these important people from the capital, Thimphu. They're visiting them. They're so overwhelmed and impressed that these people have come, and they say yes to anything that they're asked. And this reporter from the Bhutan Observer saw this going on, and because he was also from a poor village, he could see exactly what was going on. So after these important men with their ledgers left, he asked the local farmers, and are you happy? And they said, well, of course not. We haven't got enough food to eat. And he was able to unpack, using his skills as a journalist and using his voice as a journalist and his platform, he was able to bring that to the fore in a way that their institutionalised structures weren't.
No, indeed. How did the story go down, though?
Beautifully. It's what they wanted. It's part of this kind of change and dynamism even the Gross National Happiness Commission themselves, who were conducting the survey, were happy that it came out. That's what they're trying to, you know, dismantle and discover.
You mentioned earlier that there's now something like 12 newspapers and they're all sort of struggling.
Yes.
What about, and also that the country is very, it's a spoken culture. Where does that leave social media, something like Facebook?
Yes. Well, this is what has been such an extraordinary change for them. So while newspapers arrived and were struggling, at the same time digital media arrived, mobile phones were phenomenally successful. There's something like 93% of households have a mobile phone.
Wow.
And they use them to do all sorts of things. They use them to stream radio. So you've got yak farmers in remote mountain areas who are completely up to date with what's happening in politics and streaming Parliament live on their mobile phones. They're a terribly politically engaged culture. But then they're also using Facebook. Facebook has been phenomenal. It's created this space where they now have all that public discussion that the King wanted to happen in the newspapers, but it just being an oral culture, the newspapers weren't so successful. Modern media, digital media, has created this space for all of that. So the Facebook pages are, they use them for political activism, for culture, they use like a virtual town square. Facebook has been, somehow it has absolutely culturally been appropriate for them. They love it.
So this change that the king instigated, it's working. And it might, what it's doing, though, is exposing problems of if you don't have enough to eat, if you, and, you know, there's a lot of poverty in a country like Bhutan. It's not the Shangri-La that we, it's too often easy to think of, a country which celebrates and, you know, gross national happiness. These changes, beginning with newspapers, but also with mobiles and social media, they're actually making a difference.
Yes. What I found so interesting going back there again and again is that before newspapers arrived, before television arrived, in particular television, there was a lot of talk in the West and concern that it would ruin Bhutan, all this outside influence. But actually what the Bhutanese are doing with all these modern media is they're using it to talk amongst themselves, and they're using it to reflect their own culture to each other. And before mobile phones and things, if you're talking about remote farmers, they would see other farmers once a year at the annual Seshu, the festival. Now they have a media space where they find about history, about their leaders, about their culture. So it's created a really vibrant space where they're talking and they're animated and they're criticising and showcasing all things that are important to them.
Bunty Avieson is the author of The Dragon's Voice, How Modern Media Found Bhutan. You'll find more details on our website at abc.net.au/rn. The Media Report is produced by Kyla Slaven. Our sound engineer is Lila Schunner. I'm Richard Addy. Thanks for listening.